Thank you, thank you, Vice-Chancellor, and thank you all for coming this evening. I don't think I am going to be able to answer your question, so yes. okay, well, this is just one of my research interests that I've been following over the years, but it's been the most persistent. As Michael indicated, this was the topic of my PhD thesis, and it's the one strand of my research that has gone on for all these years. So I thought it was most appropriate to talk about this aspect of my research this evening. Now, there's two aspects to this subtitle. The obvious one, losing thread, is that it's what some poor comprehenders tend to do when they're trying to understand. They lose the thread. But what I also wanted to try to bring out, rather less obviously, is that there's a neglected strand to reading research. There's been a huge amount of research on children's problems in learning to read words and how we might best teach them to decode words and the sorts of skills and abilities that underlie that. And an awful lot of the research in that area has been done by Peter Bryant, who will be doing the vote of thanks. But even now, I mean, I've been bashing away at reading comprehension for rather longer than I care to remember, but even now, there's still a relative dearth of research in that area. So there's also the sort of lost strand to the research that I was trying to allude to. Okay, well, obviously, being good at reading words and reading comprehension is going to be fundamental to educational achievement. In all areas. But poor reading comprehension might also have pretty serious consequences. And I just want to bring one example of possibly serious consequences to your attention. It's an example brought to my attention by Rick Wagner, who's a fellow reading researcher, whose grandfather was an immigrant to the US. And in those days, the immigrants had to go through Ellis Island. And this is a picture of the main building on Ellis Island. There's not really pictures in this talk, so I thought I'd throw this one in. It's not a very good one, but anyway. And Rick Wagner's grandfather was asked, if admitted to this country, the United States, would you advocate overthrow, so I thought, I don't know why this is supposed to be this, but it's not supposed to be funny, of the government by force or violence? This isn't too far from the sort of questions that you're currently asked if you have to fill in a US visa waiver form. I'll come back to this at the end if I have time. And what he replied was, violence. So, getting the answer wrong to this comprehension question could have had pretty severe consequences. Somehow or other, he managed to get into the US anyway. I don't think that the immigration authorities would be quite so lenient nowadays. Okay. Right. Well, I want to step back a little bit now and talk about what it means to comprehend. And I thought I needed to make clear that by comprehension, we sometimes talk about the process of comprehension, which is what I'm primarily interested in and going to be talking about, and sometimes the product, which is typically measured by responses to comprehension tests, so the fact that you have understood. So I'm primarily interested in the process and trying to understand what goes on as we comprehend or fail to comprehend, what goes wrong with comprehension. Okay, so I'm concerned with the processes that lead to the products which are assessed by comprehension tests. And obviously, an important goal of research into comprehension and what goes wrong with it should be to identify ways of improving comprehension. If we want this to have some practical consequences, and I'd like to think that it will ultimately have some practical consequences, then we need to know how to foster comprehension. So I want to talk about the progress that I've been making towards that goal. And just to tell you where this talk is going, I'm going to say a little bit about what comprehension is, or what I understand by comprehension. You might disagree with some aspects of this. How poor comprehenders can be identified, or more precisely, how we've identified poor comprehenders, so that the participants in our research. The sorts of things that poor comprehenders do and don't do well, so the sorts of problems they have. Whether there are some fundamental causes of comprehension problems or success at comprehension. And, of course, identifying causes is going to be very important if we want to know what to train, because there's no point in trying to improve things that aren't causally implicated. So that's just an overview of the main points I'll be addressing in the talk. Okay, so what is comprehension? Well, first of all, it's an integrative process in which we've got to combine information from different sentences. So a very simple example, John was at the beach, he trod on some broken glass, he had to go to hospital. So in order to understand this as a text rather than a set of unrelated sentences, we have to make those linkages between John, he, and he again. So these are anaphoric linkages in the text that connect up the sentences. And we understand, as good comprehenders, that he refers to John. So I'm just realising I have my pointer. Sorry, can you not hear me very well? I wonder if I move this a bit closer. Is that any better? A bit better? I'll try and stand a bit. It shouldn't be. Maybe it will help if I stand close to this as well. Wave at me if you can't, say if I'm dipping too low. It's too loud here. Okay. But not only do we have to integrate the sentences, we have to add in information from background knowledge. So comprehension is also a constructive process in which we supplement what's actually in the text with information that we have in our long-term memories or our knowledge. So in this same text, there's information about where John was, that he trod on broken glass, and he ended up in hospital. So in order to understand what this is all about, we have to bring to bear the knowledge that if someone's on the beach, they're likely to have bare feet or flimsy sandals. If they tread on broken glass, then that's likely to lead to a cut foot. And since he had to go to hospital, it was probably quite a bad cut, and we might make other inferences, like he probably had stitches. So we use this information to help us interpret even a relatively short and simple text like this. And going back to the thread metaphor, you can see that in understanding the text, we are threading together different bits of information in this text or making these sorts of links. Okay, so to summarise what is comprehension, you could say that skilled comprehension is the outcome of the construction of this coherent, integrated representation of the meaning of the text, which is sometimes called a mental model or a situation model of the text. And these are the main theorists who have proposed this sort of idea. Okay. How can poor comprehenders be identified? Well, I'm going to focus specifically on the poor comprehenders that we've looked at. So this is really how we have identified children with comprehension problems. And we give them a test called the Neale Analysis of Reading Ability, in which the children read a series of passages that increase in difficulty. This is a relatively easy passage. They're corrected as they read the words. They get a score for the number of words that they read wrongly or refuse, can't read at all. They get a score for the number so that they can correctly read, so that's the wrong words are deducted. And they get a score for the number of comprehension questions that they can accurately answer. So at the end of the test, they have a reading accuracy score and a reading comprehension score. And so what we do is select children. These children are 7 3/4. These are fairly typical groups. Children who have good word reading accuracy for their age, as measured by the NEEL. So they're above average in reading accuracy. But these groups differ quite dramatically in comprehension skill, nearly 2 years. And in particular, the poorer comprehenders have comprehension that is considerably lower than you'd expect from their word recognition accuracy, and the good comprehenders have better comprehension. We also give them a vocabulary assessment, and they're matched on that. Just to mention, because it's something I'm often asked about, these children really have a general comprehension problem. It's not specifically reading. If you give them listening comprehension tests, they also have problems with inference and integration, even if you read them the texts. And they have problems with reading comprehension measures, even if those are administered orally. So it seems that it's a much more general problem than reading. So what are the characteristics of these children who have comprehension problems as measured on a standardised test? Well, there's little evidence that they differ in their word decoding speed or automaticity or accuracy. Now, it'd be pretty surprising if they differed in word reading accuracy, since we match them on word reading accuracy. But some theorists, notably Perfetti in the States, have argued that basically, comprehension problems boil down to word-level problems, that these children might be able to read accurately, but they're not reading automatically enough. Now, what I just said about listening comprehension, of course, argues against that point. But we've also assessed these children's word-reading fluency, and the poor comprehenders don't differ. They're quick, accurate, fluent word readers. So it's not an automaticity problem. Now, this doesn't mean, of course, that some children don't have comprehension problems because they're poor at word reading. Of course, if you can't read the words, you're going to have trouble understanding the text. But the point I want to make here is that we're looking at children who have comprehension problems despite having perfectly adequate word reading, good word reading, fluent word reading. Okay, these children, by and large, don't differ in tests of syntactic understanding, so they're perfectly good at understanding sentences, even quite complicated sentences. They don't differ in on short-term memory tasks, and they don't differ in memory for the exact wording of sentences or short texts. So it's not, and in fact, if you give them a comprehension assessment and you leave the text there for them to look back to, the poor comprehenders still have problems answering the questions. So it's not just a memory problem. Okay, what do they have problems with? Well, I want to mention three main areas. Now, these are the areas that we've focused on in our research. They're possibly not the only areas in which children who have comprehension problems have deficits. But I'm going to mention these, and particularly the tasks that we've used, because I'm going to come back to tell you about a longitudinal study in which we've used precisely these tasks. So if you could bear these in mind. The first one's an integration and inference task. And we want to know if these children have specific problems making different sorts of inferences from text. So we gave them short stories, and this is just an excerpt from one of the stories. And the relevant question here is, where did Michael get the orange juice from? Okay. Well, in order to answer this question, the child has to connect up ideas in the text. So they've got to connect up Michael getting some drink out of his bag and the orange juice. And it's a reasonable inference that the orange juice is it's one and the same as the drink that he got out of his bag. So the correct answer would be he got it out of his bag. Seems simple, but believe me, poor comprehenders have trouble with this sort of inference. Another sort of inference might be one that relates background knowledge to the text. So again, excerpt from this short text. This question asks, where did Debbie and Michael spend the afternoon? Well, it doesn't say explicitly that they were at the beach or by the seaside, but if you use the cue words in the text, that there's mention of a swimming costume, paddling, sandcastles, a pier, then it's a pretty good bet that they were by the seaside. So, again, the child has to use these cue words, thread these together to build a picture of the situation where this text is taking place. Okay. In this particular study, we also had an extra group of children, and the precise relevance of these will become evident later, but I'm just going to mention them now in relation to this study. What we had was a younger group. So we had the good and poor comprehenders that you've seen before. These poor comprehenders have particularly poor comprehension relative to the good group. And then we have this extra group who have the same absolute level of comprehension skill as the older poor comprehenders, but are absolutely normal readers. This is a bit coincidental, but they were just bang on average for their age. Okay. So what we're interested in is how these younger children do in relation to the older poor comprehenders. What we find on these, the children also were asked about literal information in the text. They're perfectly good at doing that. Looks a bit down, but no significant differences between the groups. Inability to answer questions that tap literal information about the text. The poor comprehenders, however, have trouble with these text connecting inferences. That was like the orange juice question. And they're worse than both the skill group and the younger normal readers. They also have problems with the knowledge-based inferences, and they're significantly worse on both sorts of inferences than the skill group. Slightly worse, but not significantly, than the younger readers. So these younger readers are actually doing considerably better than older, poor comprehenders. So I'll come back to the relevance of this in a few minutes, that particular difference. Now, I wouldn't like you to think that these children, these poor comprehenders, just have problems with background knowledge. Obviously, background knowledge is going to be useful in supporting comprehension, but it's certainly not the whole story. And we've got several sources of evidence to show that poor comprehenders do have the relevant knowledge, they just don't seem to be using it adequately when they're comprehending. And one study that shows this quite strikingly was a so-called GAN study, in which we actually made sure that the children's knowledge base was equal by teaching them a novel knowledge base. So we taught all the children some facts about an imaginary planet, which was called GAN, such as, you know, the rivers are filled with orange juice, shoes have wings, the flowers are hot like fire. And then we asked them questions. They had a story about GAN, and asked them questions that relied on them making inferences based on these knowledge items. We taught them the knowledge to criterion, which was perfect. All of them knew all of these items. And then we ask them the questions from the story. What we find is that the poor comprehenders, the less skilled comprehenders, have problems on two sorts of inferences relative to the skilled group. And this is, we ask them about the knowledge base after they've read the story. This is the proportion correct given that they remember the knowledge base items. They tended to, you know, forget the odd one or two after the story. So after we check that out, this is conditionalized on them remembering the knowledge. So even after they've learnt the knowledge, and even after we've checked that they remember the knowledge, the good comprehenders are considerably and significantly better at making inferences. So it's not just having the knowledge. Okay, the second area I want to mention is to do with understanding how stories are structured. And we've tackled this in various ways. For instance, some work that I did with Nicola Yule, we showed that the poor comprehenders are worse at picking out, they can't identify the main point of a story, even when it's a picture story, so no words involved. And in a task that I'm going to tell you a bit more about, in a story production task, we find that poor comprehenders don't produce such well-structured stories. Now, again, I mention this because it's quite far from reading. The children aren't doing any reading. They're not doing any listening. They're actually producing stories in this case. So part of the reasoning for this experiment was to see how general their problems might be. Do these problems go beyond reading and listening to producing stories as well? Okay, we had various conditions, but the most interesting one was a topic prompt condition where the children just had a title, like The Pirates or The Holiday, and they were just asked to tell a story that went with that title. It was all done orally, tape recorded and so on, transcribed. And we classified their productions into three levels and gave them a score, and I'll show you some examples of what those look like. Non-stories, well, fairly obviously non-stories, typically very short, nothing happens. We did ask the children, you know, are you sure that's the end of your story? Would you like to say anything else? And, but no, this was it. Probably wanted to get back away from this horrible experiment or something. Intermediate stories are quite interesting because they're nicely connected in that the sentences are connected. So the family goes to the seaside. They, the family, saw lots of people there at the seaside. The baby of the family, and so on. So the sentences hang together. So it's a nicely coherent, structured story in that one sentence follows on from the other, but it has this kind of and then feel to it. Nothing happens in this story. There's no main point. There's no crisis. It's just what I think of as a very flatly structured story. Contrast that with the what we call a complete story. It's in some ways not quite such a good story. It's a bit bizarre, but it has a main point. The lion has escaped from the circus. And in order to resolve this crisis, Gigi's mother, who must have a death wish for Gigi, sends Gigi out with some kippers, that well-known delicacy beloved of lions, to tempt the lion back into his cage. And luckily for Gigi, she's successful and apparently survives this ordeal. So that story has, it's got a crisis, it's got a main point, the escaped lion, and there's a resolution to this. So you can, I think of this more as like, you know, a story that has a structure, goes up to some crisis point and then resolution. Okay, so what did we find? Well, just to assure you that the poorer comprehenders, we also had a younger control group in this experiment. The poorer comprehenders said a lot, so it's not like they were tongue-tied. I don't want you to think that they all produce these non-story sort of one sentence. They're quite verbal children. Okay? But what they said was not terribly well structured, and they're producing significantly less well structured stories than either of the comparison groups here. Now, I should say that I don't think that what these children are doing worse is necessarily something that's very specific to producing stories. I think that probably what we're seeing here is something more like what other people have called a drive for coherence. So whether children are producing stories or listening to text, the better comprehenders are trying to connect up the ideas, find the thread again, if you like. The poorer comprehenders are not so aware of the overall coherence, whether it's production or comprehension. And I'll come back to that at the end when I mention possible ways of improving comprehension. Okay, what we did, just briefly, this is the one to bear in mind for the longitudinal study, because story production is a bit long-winded and we wanted something a bit quicker and easier to do in our longitudinal study with groups of children. We used yet another measure, which also relates to comprehension skill, We call this a story anagram task. The children were given stories of this sort, which have a clear ordering of the sentences. There's really only one correct ordering. They're given the sentences in a jumbled form, and they're asked to number the sentences in the correct ordering. Okay, so you get a relation between their ordering and the actual correct ordering. And good comprehenders are better at doing this task. It's a very good predictor of comprehension skill. So this is a task to bear in mind for the longitudinal study. This is the one that we used. Okay, the third area that I want to mention is comprehension monitoring. So in order to be a good comprehender, you've not only got to understand, but you've also got to understand when your understanding goes wrong. So you've got to monitor your comprehension. And part of this is thinking about what you might need to do if you find that your comprehension's failing. Maybe you've had a lapse of attention and you need to backtrack. Maybe there's too many words that you don't know in the text and you need to get out a dictionary, or maybe you decide the book's just so boring that you're going to give up on it. But you, as a good comprehender, you will automatically be monitoring how your comprehension's going. One way to test this that we and others have used is to give children texts with problems in them. So in this text, the problem is that there's an inconsistency between the sentences. Here it says moles can't see very well, and here it says that moles have good eyesight. So children were given a mixture of texts like this, texts that didn't have problems, and asked to say if there was a problem, and if so, what it was. This asterisk here means that sometimes the sentences with the problem, if you put them together, were adjacent. So sometimes this sentence would be down here. And that made things a bit easier, particularly for the poor comprehenders. So if we look at their success in picking out these problems, good comprehenders are better, and they don't really differ much depending on the distance between the conflicting bits of information. Poor comprehenders are generally worse, and they're particularly disadvantaged in the more distant condition. So it seems that poor comprehenders have difficulties with this sort of comprehension monitoring task. So just a quick summary so far. What I hope to have demonstrated is that poor comprehenders have problems in at least these three areas. I'm sort of glossing over the issue of whether these are really distinct or interrelated areas, but given the limited time, I'm not going to go into that today. Okay, but a list of things that children differ on is not terribly informative, because these could be simply correlates of comprehension skill. So if children are good at inference making, maybe that's because they're good comprehenders and they've had lots of practice at inference making because they've read a lot. And so maybe they got to be good at inference making through being good comprehenders. Maybe it's not a fundamental causal factor. So as I said earlier, if we want to train comprehension, we want to know what might be causally implicated in comprehension development. And this is a pretty tricky issue. It's always difficult to get at causality, but we've tried to do this in various ways, which I'm going to tell you about now. Okay, so that's what we want to know. Is there a causal link? Well, the ways of exploring causal hypotheses in reading research, at least, are to do comprehension age match studies, and you've already seen some of those, and I'm going to tell you about what we can infer from those in a moment. Longitudinal studies and training studies, and we've actually done all three of these sorts of studies, and I think that the results are converging quite nicely. So I'm going to tell you a bit more about studies in each of these areas. Well, very briefly about the comprehension age match design, because you've already seen the studies. So if you can remember those on the inference study and the story production study, the poor comprehenders actually did worse than these younger children with the same absolute level of comprehension skill. Okay, so this is just the design which you've seen. So, if the comprehension age match group are better at some things than poor comprehenders, they can't be better because of their comprehension level, because their comprehension level is the same. Okay. So a causal link from the other in the other direction from whatever it is that these younger children are better at, say inference making, to comprehension is more likely. It's not proven, but we can rule out the link in the other direction. Okay, poor comprehenders can't be worse at inference making because they've got worse comprehension. Because in this design, they haven't, and they're still worse at inference making. Okay. So that rules out a causal link in that direction. Okay, so we've got some evidence from these sorts of studies that that inference making and whatever it is that this story production task is measuring, and I suggested a drive for coherence, might be causally implicated in comprehension development. Okay, then we've done a longitudinal study, and we assess these children during the primary school years from 7 up to 11. And so what we're particularly interested in is the link between these children's early skills and abilities and their later reading ability, to look at what are the best predictors across time. And again, we can make causal inferences about what's causing what from those sorts of data. We also wanted to know in the longitudinal study whether different components predict comprehension and word reading across time. There's pretty good evidence from many studies, that phonological skills are very good predictors of word reading accuracy across time. But we didn't know anything really about what predicts comprehension skills across time and whether there are very distinct predictors, because that would have implications for teaching reading as well. And we also wanted to know which sub-skills that we measured early on predicted variance in later comprehension skill, to try and make some causal inferences. Okay, this is just a summary of the variables that we included in the longitudinal study. So Neil, I mentioned the Neil test, so we had Neil accuracy and Neil comprehension as our outcome measures, what we were trying to predict. I've kind of backgrounded the things that didn't turn out to be terribly interesting, but just to mention that they were included. So the things in white were the more interesting, and down the bottom you'll see these three measures, which were measured by the tasks that I've mentioned, inference task, comprehension monitoring task, and the anagram task to look at story structure understanding. Okay. Right. Well, this is it's a load of spaghetti, but I'll try and take you through this. This is the results of a path analysis on the data from the longitudinal study. What I want you to note, first of all, these are, for anybody who wants to know, the numbers in brackets are the partial correlations, and the first numbers are the standardized beta weight. So these give you an indication of the strength of the relation if those terms don't mean anything to you. So you know, the highest possible perfect relation would be 1. But this is a pretty strong link. Okay, so comprehension is strongly predicting, accounting for variance in later comprehension skill. And what's important about this is all this stuff underneath that comprehension line comes in even after we've taken account statistically of this strong link with comprehension across time. Okay, so comprehension is by far the strongest predictor of later comprehension. But over and above that, all these other things have some predictive power. And what I particularly want to point out is that either directly or indirectly, the three measures of these comprehension skills that I've been talking about, the story anagram task, the comprehension monitoring task, and inference making from stories are accounting for variance in later comprehension. To say that is even after we've taken into account the effects of comprehension. So this is these data present a reasonable argument for a causal influence of these skills, because they can't be having this influence on later comprehension simply through their association with earlier comprehension. That's already taken account of in this analysis. I'm not going to show you the corresponding spaghetti diagram for word reading accuracy, but the picture was quite different. None of these skills account for later variance in reading accuracy. Only a phonological processing task accounted for reading accuracy across time. So quite different predictors of word reading accuracy and reading comprehension across time. Okay, what can we conclude from longitudinal study? Well, first of all, we've identified, again, some of these subs, but not just in a correlational analysis, some of these sub-skills that account for, that are important in predicting later reading comprehension, and reading comprehension specifically, not reading accuracy. And as I've tried to emphasize, it's important that these skills are predictive over and above early measures of comprehension. And one thing I didn't really point out is even in competition with general ability measures like verbal IQ and vocabulary. Of course, vocabulary is important in comprehension, but like general knowledge, it's certainly not the be-all and end-all. Okay. Another conclusion from the longitudinal study is that there's a clear dissociation between predictors of word reading on the one hand and comprehension skill on the other hand. And that, of course, has implications for teaching. People, I don't think so much nowadays, but people often used to suppose that if you taught children to decode the words, everything else would fall into place because these children could understand spoken language. But it doesn't, and now in the national curriculum, there's more emphasis on training, teaching comprehension skills to all children, not just those with problems. And we've identified possible causal factors, inference making from both the comprehension age match studies and from the longitudinal study, comprehension monitoring from the longitudinal study, and story structure understanding. Though, as I said, you know, this might be something a bit broader than story structure understanding from both the comprehension age match and the longitudinal studies, using rather different tasks in those two sorts of studies. So, the next logical question is, how do we improve comprehension? Is training in these skills going to help children's comprehension? So what can be done to foster comprehension? This is my last main point. I'm just going to mention, we haven't done a lot in the way of training studies, in fact. I've kind of stepped back from those to look at causal issues. And this is quite an old training study, which again I did with Nicola Yule. But in general, the training studies that we've conducted have focused on processing strategies and trying to get children to think about how they can use their existing knowledge and apply that to understanding the text, and thinking about whether their understanding is adequate, so encouraging comprehension monitoring. So more broadly, you could say that the training studies have tried to get the children more aware of and more involved in their comprehension, to encourage them to make inferences and monitor their understanding. So in this study that I did with Nicola, we gave the children quite a short period of training, 7 30-minute sessions in small groups. And we gave them various sorts of training, getting them to make inferences from single words in a sentence, so something about the character and what they might infer about that. Getting them to generate questions about short texts, and importantly to discuss each other's answers to these questions, why they thought that somebody else's answer was good or not so good, and what might be a better response. So they sort of took turns at being interrogator, and getting them to predict, to think about what they knew about the text so far and what might happen next. And so parts of the text were literally covered up, and the children talked about what might occur in the text, and then the text was uncovered and they checked their predictions and again discussed these in their small groups. We had two control groups. One group was given what we thought would be sort of rather boring old comprehension exercises. It turned out not to be quite so boring, I think because we allowed them to discuss their responses, and this probably turned out to be quite crucial. An automated word reading, which sounds incredibly tedious, but the children actually found this quite fun because they had a stopwatch and they had to read the words in the text as rapidly as possible. And just tried to get faster and faster and faster at that, and then they were tested on texts that had the same words in them. This relates back to this issue of, you know, it's all about fluency and automaticity, and it's not. Okay, so what happened? Well, rapid decoding, this is a few months, I think about 4 months later on a different version of the test, so everybody gets a bit better, but there's actually no significant difference between the groups given rapid decoding. Certainly doesn't help the poor comprehenders more than the good ones. So-called reciprocal teaching is what I just described to you, where they do these various activities in small groups. Much bigger and highly significant improvement for the poor comprehenders compared with the good comprehenders there. And the rather disappointing aspect of these results was the comprehension exercises, because we didn't expect these to have much impact, but in fact they also improved the poor comprehenders' comprehension. This is comprehension reassessed on a standardised, on the Neil analysis a few months later. So it's assessed on a standardised comprehension measure. The kids doing the comprehension exercises also improved, but I don't want you to go away with the idea that comprehension exercises, you know, where the child reads the text and sits down and answers questions about it in isolation, are a jolly good thing. What we think was going on here is that the children were doing these comprehension exercises, but they were also discussing the answers in small groups. And also the texts were slightly obscure ones to encourage them to make inferences and think about them. So this is obviously something we need to look at more, you know, what factors are causing this improvement. But anyway, the reciprocal teaching was the most effective form of comprehension training. Okay, so just briefly to summarise that, the short-term training, and it was only a few hours of training, increased performance on a standardised comprehension assessment. The poor comprehenders improved more than the good ones, and the comprehension training was vastly superior to training in rapid decoding. Okay, happily, these conclusions from our this and other training studies we've done are very consistent with training studies more generally. In fact, there's 7 main categories of comprehension instruction that have been identified as having evidence for their effectiveness. And all of these have the characteristic that they draw the reader into a more active engagement with the text, so more active processing of text. And these sorts of strategies, not just from our work, but other work, include comprehension monitoring. Hope some of these will sound familiar. Question answering, question generation, summarization, which again would have some elements of understanding structure to it. And so all of these strategies are things which are going to encourage readers to produce a more integrated representation in text and to connect up ideas. So if we go back to the idea of a drive for coherence, these sorts of strategies are going to be the ones that encourage readers to try to produce a coherent, integrated representation of a text. Okay, the main conclusions that I'd like to draw out from the talk as a whole then are that word decoding and language comprehension are separable aspects of reading, and I'm certainly not the only person who's said this, but I think what we've shown is that these are predicted by separate skills and abilities. So it's certainly not enough to teach children to read words and hope that everything will fall into place. Very often it does, but for a significant percentage of children, and we and others have found that about 8 to 10% of children who aren't identified by their teachers as having any reading problems can be classified as poor comprehenders using our criteria. Obviously it depends how, you know, what criteria you use, but it's not an insignificant number who have these comprehension difficulties, which often go unnoticed. But happily, training and even quite short-term training encourages readers to make inferences and integrate information seems to be quite effective, at least in the short term. We need to know about the longer-term effects of training as well. And there's certainly much more on comprehension in the more recent incarnations of the National Literacy Strategy. So, just to finish off, what was Rick Wagner's grandfather's problem? Perhaps I should ask you, since you've had all this time to ponder on this. Well, I would suggest that this guy didn't really appreciate the pragmatics of the questioning situation. He didn't use his integration, inference, and his metacognitive skills, certainly, to think about who was asking this question, the US government, and what sort of answers they might like to hear. But, happily, the US immigration authorities do seem to have learnt something in the interim about how to improve comprehension, at least the product of comprehension. Whether this was down to Rick Wagner's grandfather, I wouldn't like to hypothesise. But they still ask these wonderful questions. This is an excerpt from a current US visa waiver form. You know, it basically boils down to, you know, are you a drug addict? Are you a criminal? Are you a spy or a terrorist? But the reason that the way in which they've improved the product is that they very helpfully given you a prompt. So you only have to say yes or no. You don't have to understand all this stuff. Right, well, lastly, but certainly not leastly, thanks to everybody and everything who's supported this research, the ESRC in particular for funding, and a number of these have, I mean, there's been other people as well, but these have really been the main collaborators in my research over the years, roughly in order of appearance in my life, and a number of these people have become very good friends and have made, they've not only been wonderful collaborators, but they made the research a lot more fun as well. So many have become good friends, and some of them have even become husbands. So thank you, and if you have any questions, not about US immigration procedures, please, but about comprehension, I mean, I've really kind of glossed over lots of things, so if you're interested in this area and you'd like some sort of summary chapters or whatever, I'd be very happy to send you information. There's my email. Thank you.
Well, Jane, thank you. to ask Professor Brand to come up and say a few words. Professor Brand is from the University of Oxford.
Well, thank you to the university for clearing up this interesting part of your backlog. And thank you, backlog, but that's why I'm here, for a really riveting and most enjoyable lecture. I wonder sometimes why I always do find it so pleasurable to hear Jane talking about her work when I know about it pretty well already. And I think what it is that I always marvel at her independence and persistence, as well as her obvious originality. As she mentioned very briefly, a lot of the very successful research on reading, particularly reading in children, over the last 20 years or so, has been at the level, a quite different level from the one she's been working at herself. It's been at the level of reading and writing single words like fun and light and laugh. And that work has gone extremely well, but it has been Jane's achievement to say that it's not the only important level, that there, as well as reading words, children have to get at the meaning of words in text, of several words at any one time. And the point having been made is obviously a really very good one, but I would like to pay tribute to Jane for making it so well and so stubbornly for such a long time. Now, one thing I'd like to point out is that she has not done it in a confrontational way, which in psychology is most unusual. Psychologists love to have battles. They fall out. They don't talk to each other. There are even some universities, you can hardly believe this, where there have been separate psychology departments. Amazing, shocking. But Jane didn't pursue this at all. She respected and showed she did the work on a different level, but she pointed out that there may be another level too. And her work and her ideas on this have had an extraordinary influence. I'm sure most of you know this already, and it's a quite justified influence. Her main insights, if I can sum it up, I think, are that understanding text involves a lot of hidden cognitive work. To understand a sentence or a simple story, it's not just a matter of deciphering the words. You have to do a lot of work to find out what these words together actually do mean. That, it seems to me, is the first and fundamental insight, and her work has shown it to be true. And the second, and at least as important, is that this work comes much more easily for some children, one son, than for others, the other son. And she gave you the answer, I think. And these together, I think, really are a considerable achievement. I am very aware of another person who I think made a great stride forward in psychology by pointing out that there are aspects of cognition which we simply cannot take for granted. And this is Piaget. And it was his great contribution to point out that, and to show, without any doubt, that a lot of young children, for example, it's just one of his bits of work, find it very, very hard to understand that perceptual aspects of sets of objects have very little to do with the actual number. In other words, he was able to show that there are aspects of understanding number which we take for granted, we grown-ups, but which are very tough for children, a huge insight. And it seems to me that Jane Oakhill's work, in that sense, takes very much the same form. It's a hugely interesting, but also very, very, very valuable insight. And she, in a way, has taken it further than the said Piaget, because she has also worked very hard on individual differences, which I take to be tremendously important. So the work itself is great. It's, as you saw, a combination of different methods, which I think is always a very powerful thing. Thing to do, of longitudinal studies, of straightforward experiments, of training studies, of complex path analyses, very well explained, by the way, of individual differences. And I think put together, this work over all this time has made an extraordinarily strong case, and a very powerful one. And it's rich. It's not just a question of what Jane's done, but of what she's going to do, and of what other people will do taking up her work. I can think of loads of things myself. Maybe I meant to check whether she hasn't done these things, but I forgot to do that. One thing it seems to me is just the straightforward educational implications, which are great, which are really important. That here is something which we well-read adults, researchers, cognitive psychologists, teachers, we easily take for granted because it comes so easily to us. And, I think that is something which it is important not just to include in the National Literacy Strategy, and I'm glad to hear that's beginning to happen at last, but also in teaching of teachers. I think this is really terrifically important, that teachers themselves should know about this at the time that they are taught about teaching. That's one thing. Another thing, it seems to me, is that the kind of inferences that Jane is talking about and established so well in the work that she's done are, at any rate in the social sphere, quite akin, I think, to the kind of inferences that have been studied over the last 10, 15 years in another very successful research enterprise, and that is what's called theory of mind, which is the study of getting to understand what another person's viewpoint is in social interaction. And it seems to me that there are huge connections to be made in that direction. Again, I don't know whether Jane's done it or not, or will do it, but somebody's going to do it sooner or later. I think, therefore, that what we have is something of a gold mine. And mention of a gold mine makes, and that story about Rick Wagner's grandfather, actually in a roundabout way makes me think of an experience of mine. I had a brilliant supervisor for my PhD who was called Artie Hamelin, who spent her first 30 years or so, first in Berlin and then in Jerusalem. By the time I became a student, her English was really excellent, but she always had difficulties with various metaphors and idioms. She would come in and say, "Why do you say that so-and-so, not so-and-so, into a cocked hat?" I don't know where this comes from. One day we were talking about somebody who had achieved a bit of a success, something like the Spearman Medal, who knows. It happened to be somebody we weren't terribly fond of. And she said to me, "Never mind, I'm sure it's just a flash in the pants." Well, in this case, I think what was the problem? The problem was she didn't have the world knowledge, which is, I think, it is the case, flash in the pants expression from 19th century gold prospecting, when people looked in pants or, you know, all that sort of stuff. At any rate, what I'd like to finish by saying is that, Jane, your work is neither flash in the pan or a flash in the pants. it's a genuine goal. It's a very rich theme, and not just you, and not just the university, but I think the whole research community, and in the end, I think the whole education world will benefit from it. So I'd like you to join me in thanking Jane for showing us this gold mine and letting us enter.
Brian, thank you very much indeed for coming today and going.